coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor, said to have a second language is to have a second soul.
Which comes first, language or thought?
People have been debating this question for quite some time. I think it's interesting that we talk about language as not just a form of communication, but also as a mode of thought.
We use language to think. Does that mean language must come before thought?
What language is telling you is, these are the things that people before you have found important, the small set of categories that we find useful. Language is very sparse, and it only marks a very small proportion of what we actually know.
Our guest is Stanford psychologist Lera Boroditsky.
To me, it doesn't make sense to say, is it language that shapes thought or is it culture that shapes thought? One is a part of the other.
Language and thought, coming up on Philosophy Talk
after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, Loco Innovative Public Radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. Go check it out.
And you can also get podcasts through our website. Now, Ken, today's topic is thought and language. Now, I know the difference between thought and language. Thought goes on in your head. Language comes out of your mouth. You have something more sophisticated to add?
Well, it's not a question about the difference between thought and language. It's about the relationship between thought and language. I mean, you can have this view that the thoughts are up there just waiting to get out and you need some language and then boom, right? But you can also have the view that dates back to Sapir and Whorf that language helps shape thought. I mean, the thinkable is somehow determined by the language in which you talk and think, because language construes the world for you. And I think there's something to that hypothesis, although philosophers have kind of not liked it recently.
I don't like it. I mean, the big deal is supposed to be the Eskimos and snow. Now, even if the facts are right, which I guess is in doubt, I would have thought the reason the Eskimos have a lot of words for snow is because they have a lot of different ways of thinking about snow. And the reason they have a lot of different ways of thinking about snow is because they have a lot of different kinds of snow that they have to figure out what to do in and with.
No, but you're putting it too simplistically. You're thinking the world just impresses itself upon us, and then we just automatically, it demands to be categorized and thought about in a certain way. But no, we need these categories in our head. This dates back to Kant. The categories in our head construes the world for us. And if you don't think like Kant, there's a fixed set of categories, and that there's a variable set of categories from language to language and culture to culture. Where do they come from? The language gives them to you, provides them for you through its grammar and its vocabulary, its syntax.
Very persuasive right up until that the language gives them to you. I think if the Eskimos didn't know the difference between snow and sleet and a hole in the ground until they had language, they never would have had language because they would have all fallen into the sea.
You're explaining why they would have a language like that, but it's by having a language like that that they can think so richly about this. Suppose those were the facts, that they could think so richly about those things.
I can see that language could kind of accumulate insights that somebody might not be able to master on their own. I think
you've almost given away the ghost there.
I would think it'd be more plausible with kind of more abstract thoughts like democracy and freedom. But you know what we should do is we should find someone that has learned a new language late in life and can say, oh, you know, when I learned that language, my worldview changed. I could just think thoughts I couldn't think before.
Well, a roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, she actually searched out a woman who's been trying to resurrect a dead language, a long dead language, and along with it, a long dead worldview. She files this report.
Historian and Ohlone native Linda Yamani has been known to sing jokingly, "Only Ohlone," because of the lonely work she's had in reviving Rumsian, the language spoken by her Northern California Ohlone ancestors.
By the time I was born in 1949, I believe that there is only one other person living who died in the 60s who knew a few words. Other than that, the last person to speak my Rumsian language died in 1939.
There may be as many as eight languages or dialects spoken by the Ohlone, but one thing's clear. The Rumsian dialect shows how nature was central to their worldview.
One thing I've really noticed in my language work is the lack of generic terms for animals, plants, insects, you know, because my ancestors lived in the natural world. It really wasn't that particularly useful to have a generic term for bird, because in most cases they would be referencing a very particular bird that had a very particular cultural importance to them.
For example, because the Ohlone ate acorns as a staple of their diet, they had very specific names for the nut.
I'm not aware of ever having encountered the word that was just generic for acorn. Rather, I end up finding names for the specific acorn species, like Sirhin is the black oak, which grows up in the mountains up at the higher elevations. Chapao is the tan oak, which is my people's favorite acorn. And Yuksh is the live oak.
It's taken Yamani 20 years of studying wax cylinders and thousands of pages of anthropologists' field notes to piece together a dictionary. Rumsian words contain all the pronouns we might expect.
We have, you know, ka for I also means mine or my. The word for you is me. And then the word for he, she, or it is wa.
But there have been some surprises for Yamani, including the word for thank you. Turns out it's not about thanking an individual, but rather sending out a message to a whole group.
To say thank you, shududu, I'll use my ancestral village as an example. You'd say, shududu tuknukt. So to thank someone would be blessing their village.
She found an Ohlone song about chasing away something that plagues people along the Northern California coast to this day, the fog.
Ara pachatiyahawan was yeyahem. The song is... It doesn't say the word fog in it, but people just know that it's addressing fog because it says pelican is hitting your wife. And so it's telling fog to go back where you came from because you need to tend to things at home. Ouch, ouch, ew.
The song's ending shows a kind of magical realism in the thinking of Yamani's ancestors in that they could shoo the fog away with a breath of air. The words connect her to the coastal life of her people and show her how they viewed the world. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that very interesting and very helpful piece. I'm John Perry. And with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Lara Boroditsky. She's a professor of psychology at Stanford University. She also got her PhD at Stanford not that long ago. And then she went off to MIT and they called her back. They said, come back to one of the world's great psychology departments. She's author of many things on this topic, including Linguistic Relativity, which is in the Encyclopedia of Cognitive Science. Lara, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Lara, John Perry here. Ken and I, you probably heard earlier, we're fumbling and bumbling around about the so-called Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Tell us what that is. Is it the view that language is a straitjacket of thought, or is there something a little more flexible going on there?
Well, the idea that language and thought might be related is an old idea. It goes long before Whorf came around. It's often associated with Benjamin Whorf because... He wrote a lot about it, but, Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor, said things like, to have a second language is to have a second soul. So Charlemagne was a Whorfian. He just didn't know it. Shakespeare took a very different position on the topic. He said that a rose by any other name would smell as sweet, which is an anti-Whorfian kind of claim.
That's right.
People have been debating this question for quite some time. The idea that language might shape thought actually comes from the simple observation that different languages talk about the world very, very differently. So I could give you some examples. Let's take a purely hypothetical example. Say I tell you that Bush read Chomsky's latest book. That's meant to be a hypothetical example.
I suspect so.
Because if you could put anybody's book in there, it would be hypothetical.
That's exactly right. I often think about whether or not people would know who Chomsky is, but I figure out anything following Bush Red is sufficiently hypothetical. So let's focus on the verb read. In English, if you want to say the statement grammatically, and if this is something that happened in the past, then you have to use the past tense of the verb to read. In some languages, you don't have to mark tense. So in Indonesian, for example, where we do a lot of work, the verb doesn't change. In other languages, you have to include more information. So in Russian, my native language, you would have to include on the verb whether the reader was male or female. So if it was Laura Bush that did the reading, you would use a different form of the verb. In Russian also, you have to include whether the event was complete or not. So if George read the whole thing from cover to cover, you would use one form of the verb. But if he just skimmed it looking for quotes to use in a speech or something like that, you would use a different form of the verb.
But let me, okay, let's grant that there is linguistic relativity. Let's call it that for a second. That, well, I don't quite want to call it that. Let's grant that languages vary in the way they mark tense or whether a verb has to be tensed or untensed, how, whether you have to have affixes or various things of the sort. Let's grant that. We look around and we see that languages differ in the ways they handle these things. What follows about thought from that?
Well, the observation that languages differ led people to think that speakers of different languages must notice different things in order to speak their languages grammatically. So if a Turkish speaker were to utter that sentence, they would have to change the verb depending on how they came to know the bit of information that they're telling you. So if they physically saw George Bush reading Chomsky's book, then they would use one form of the verb. And if they didn't, then they would use another. And that's something we don't mark in English.
But, I mean, let's go back to Indonesians who don't need to use the past tense. That doesn't mean that Indonesians don't know that there's a difference between Bush reading the book now and Bush reading the book in the past, does it? Couldn't one say that's not a difference in thought? It's just a difference in how much thought is made explicit in language.
That's a great point. Language is very sparse, and it only marks a very small proportion of what we actually know. And so on the other side, people have argued everyone, no matter what language people speak, everyone notices exactly the same things about the world. Everyone notices the full set of things that all languages could potentially mark. And language just then expresses only a small proportion of that.
Can we get out stronger and weaker versions of this hypothesis? I mean, in philosophy circles, this Pierre Wharf hypothesis led some people to think they invented this notion of incommensurability, that you could say or think things in one language that could not be said or thought in another language, so that some languages might not be intertranslatable. I mean, whole conceptual schemes might not be intertranslatable. That's a very strong hypothesis. It doesn't seem like anything you said right now supports the very strongest version of this.
I think in a strict sense, not only is there intranslatability between languages, there's intranslatability between different speakers of the same language or even the same speaker of the same language at time point one and time point two, if you were to take a very strict view on it. A good analogy to think about is the following. If I were to ask you, what is the equivalent of a shortstop in American football? You would say, I don't know, right? The question doesn't make sense. And I think the same applies to when you think about how do you really translate from one language to another. Each language is a very complex, interconnected system. And taking one element out of that system and saying what is the equivalent of that in another language is going to be really difficult.
So you think there is something to the strong version of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I have this horrible thought that this is something we can't decide just by thinking about it. We might have to do, what do they call us? Experiments. That's
well,
right.
It's a good thing we have an experimentalist here to aid us. After the break, we'll dig in to some experimental evidence for the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. You're listening to a Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is language and thought. Our guest is Lara Boroditsky from Stanford University.
We've been looking at the relationship between thought and language, the possible takes on it. In the next segment, we'll look at some real evidence about for and against the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in its various forms. We'll be taking your calls soon. Why don't you jot down this number, 415-841-4134. And outside the Bay Area, toll free, 1-800-525-9917.
Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, language or thought? Your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
King Crimson and Elephant Talk. Wittgenstein said if a lion could talk, you couldn't understand it, Ken. I don't recall him saying anything about elephants. But anyway, this is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
Our topic today is language and thought, words and ideas. To what extent are ideas dependent on words? To the fact that there are 14 tenses in French help French speakers or determine that French speakers think differently about time than English speakers? Does the fact that all verbs end in clauses in German affect the way Germans think? Any bilingual speakers out there, do you think differently in your native language and your second language? Tell us what you think.
Give us a call. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, you can call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. Finally, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Lara Boroditsky, professor of psychology from Stanford University. Lara, John and I are both, conceptual guys. We never go in a lab. You're an experimentalist. I've been actually reading some of your experimental results. Tell us, sir, what's the recent experimental work show about this superior wharf hypothesis?
One of my favorite examples comes from an Aboriginal group in Australia that Steve Levinson and his colleagues have been studying. They study people who have a very interesting property of their language. They don't have words like left and right, and sometimes not even forward or back. And instead, they express everything in terms of cardinal directions, things like north, south, east, west. Now, the consequence of having a language like this is that you have to end up saying things like, there's an ant on your southwest leg, or move the cup to the northeast. And in order to speak a language like this, you have to stay oriented. Otherwise, you can't speak the language.
Yeah, right.
So I don't want to ask you guys which way southeast is now, because you probably don't know. We're sitting in this studio. You've probably been here many times. Oh, I can see people pointing in all directions. The point is, to speak a language like that, you have to stay oriented. There's no other way to speak
it. How do you say you're left? Can you say I'm left-handed in such a language?
So there are lots of languages like this. In some languages, there will be words for different sides of the body, but they're very infrequent. They're kind of like words like ventral and dorsal in English, or you have words like that, but you don't really use them.
My guess is that these people are outdoors a lot and that the skies are fairly clear. But
you know, these languages happen all around the world, and these people stay oriented when they're indoors without being able to see the sky. And there are lots of people who live outdoors who don't have languages like this.
So much for my guess.
how do they stay oriented? They just know? How do they do that?
Well, what they do, actually, their ability...
I mean, the language doesn't enable them to do that. They need to do that in order to be able to use the language, right?
The language requires them to pay attention to and keep reorienting wherever it is they are. So the language forces them to attend to an aspect of the world that you and I don't attend to because we don't have to.
Right. Except if we're on a boat or trying to follow directions, and then it's hard for us because we don't have any kind of built-in mechanisms, socially conditioned mechanisms or something like that.
Well, we have the latent capacity to be able to attend to such things. We just don't develop it, whereas these folks do. In fact, before these folks were discovered, we thought that humans didn't have this ability. We would study navigation in ants and birds and so on, and thought that birds and ants were actually better than us at navigating. But it turns out humans do have this capacity. It's just not developed.
Now, is that a universal? But no, okay, let's think about the relativity thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so most of us don't have a language that requires us to develop that capacity, to exploit that capacity. But you just suggested that we do have that capacity. And maybe it's like this, languages, because of this sparseness of language. I mean, you and John agreed that language is sparse. And that seems right to me. Because of the sparseness of language, and it exploits some things, and some language may exploit some things and not exploit other things, well, you'll find a difference. I think in one of your articles I read something about thinking for speaking, right? You'll find a difference of what this language requires you to exploit in order to speak it and use it successfully, right? But the capacities may be universal. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, it depends on what you mean by capacity. By capacity, all you mean is everything that humans in the world have ever learned is in principle learnable, then yes, but that's a kind of a trite statement. Yes, we're all born being able to more or less learn things that humans around the world have managed to learn. The question is, what is it that you actually learn, and what kinds of mental representations do you actually form and use? There's no question about whether or not these folks stay oriented or not. I was just at an Aboriginal community in Australia this summer, and they thought I was extremely stupid because I couldn't remember, within 3 degrees of error, as you're supposed to, which way was which.
So we've got the left and the right and over there, over here. Are there other kind of things that we usually convey with indexicals and demonstratives, like up and down or me and you, that there are some languages that just don't encode? Is there some language where you just have names and you don't have me and you and I and they?
There are languages that differ a lot in the kinds of pronouns that they have. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely differences in pronouns. One of my favorite differences is between languages like English and Indonesian. In Indonesian, there's an inclusive we and an exclusive we. So if I were to turn to Ken and say, we're going to go and have a cup of coffee afterwards, I could choose to use the inclusive we that includes all of us, or I could choose to use the exclusive we that includes only me and Ken and not you, John.
I like that. Well, let's leave John out here. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about language and thought with Lara Boroditsky from Stanford University. Join our conversation, 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And Jill in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jill.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm just so happy to hear this topic because in high school I studied German and it never really occurred to me this idea. But then in college when I started learning Japanese, the idea that culture could shape the language became very clear to me because sentence structures and even just the types of words chosen to convey certain thoughts, it seemed so obvious that they had been influenced by the different culture, the way the language was shaped. And so just to know that people are studying this makes me very happy because it proves how smart I am.
So did you want to raise a question or you just want to congratulate yourself?
Idea was definitely that the culture was shaping the language more than the other way around.
Thanks for the call, Jill. Lara, she thinks you've got it backwards, I think. I'm not sure.
Well, it depends on what you mean by culture. I think language is a part of culture. So there are things that we share socially among people. So language is one constituent of culture. To me, it doesn't make sense to say, is it language that shapes thought or is it culture that shapes thought? One is a part of the other. You could ask, is it language or some other non-linguistic part of culture that shapes thought? And I think both are true.
So the real question isn't which came first, the chicken or the egg. It's just the fact that there's a wonderful fit across languages and cultures between the two, that thought and language are not independent. But let's go back to Jill's example of German. Now, the Germans have all these clauses with the verbs at the end, and when I've, in my fitful attempts to learn German over the years, I've found that does put a cognitive demand on me that I don't have in English. I have to keep track of all the players without knowing what it is, what game they're playing. Because until I get to the verb, I don't know. You know, I often thought, you know, I mean, if you were in German, you'd say, don't until you see the whites of their eyes shoot. And maybe that slows German soldiers down. Do you suppose that's possible?
People have been making hypotheses about how different languages might differ from one another for a long time. Basically, as long as there have been different languages, people have argued that Hebrew is the best language for oratory and Italian is the best language for romance and German is the best language for logic and so on. A lot of times these claims are not really based on empirical fact. They're intuitions that people have when they try to learn mm-hmm. another language.
I want to ask you about, I want to know where you stand on the issue. Chomskyans believe in something they call universal grammar. There's this innate language-specific thing in our heads, and that's not any particular language, but given some primary linguistic data, it will output a language for you. It will output English or Swahili or German or whatever. And languages differ, but in a small number of ways, or a relatively fixed number of ways. Do you believe that or not believe that?
The way Chomsky describes it is he says, imagine a Martian were to come to Earth and hear all of the world's languages. He says the Martian wouldn't even be able to tell that there are different languages being spoken. It would all sound like the same language, just spoken with slightly different accents. And that's kind of the very strong formulation of there's a whole lot of universality. Now, that, of course, also presumes a whole lot about the cognitive system of the Martian, that it would be able to pull out all these universalities that we haven't been able to do. It's certainly not the experience of humans that when you travel to a place where they speak some completely different language, you think, ah, this is just like English. This will be no problem at all. We take years and years and years to learn a language, and it's very laborious, and some people feel like they can never master another language.
And you often look at these people speaking this language, and you just have to remind yourself they're actually communicating. It just seems like a miracle that those noises could convey meaning.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing language and thought with our guest, Laura Boroditsky from Stanford University, and Hans in Palo Alto's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Hans.
Hello there.
Hello. What's your comment or question?
Well, first of all, you guys have got me snagged in the car. I can't get out of my car. This is a great conversation.
Okay, that's what we like.
And the other thing, just on the recent comments, I actually speak fluent German, and my comment there, you mentioned the Charlemagne quote, the second language, the second soul. The thing I would point out, my sense of humor changes when I speak German. It's a very strange experience.
How would you characterize this?
For the better or worse?
I think in a funny way for the worse, because it's not my sense of humor, because I didn't actually grow up in Germany, but I speak it as a native. I often get misunderstood. But
Thanks.
I have an English sense of humor in fluent German.
Makes sense. Larry, I know you've done some work on bilinguals and how they think in their second language and stuff. Could tell us something about that.
Well, one question people have had for a long time is what happens when you learn a second language? Are you just learning a new way of talking, or are you also learning a new way of thinking? So when you go and take a French class or a Japanese class, are they actually teaching you a new way of seeing the world, in addition to a new way of making noises and putting together sentences? One thing that we've studied is what happens when people have learned another language. Does that mean they have two different conceptual systems sitting in their mind, and they use one when they're speaking one language and another when they're speaking another? Or is there one integrated system? And it turns out that a little bit of both of these are true, that you both keep all of the information from all of the languages that you've learned active all the time, and you also switch a little bit depending on what language you're speaking at the moment.
Hans, I understand you're still with us, and we didn't get...
The original reason why I phoned was a thought that really words are tools, tools for storytelling, tools for storytelling. And the development of those tools are a continuous process, so that the useful, where you may begin having a whole sentence to describe a feeling or an action, somebody then coins a word, and that becomes useful, and then that becomes currency. And I'm thinking how much work sort of the professionals in this field are doing around professional vocabularies. So I'm an engineer, and there are a lot of terms. If I'm doing a project on cement, suddenly I see the world through this lens of words and frameworks to do with that industry. And the world does look different. I have different words to describe that reality. Nothing has actually changed, but I've got these very useful terms as a shorthand, as a code, to explore ideas and connections that previously would have been very clumsy.
I suppose a cement contract would have a very concrete take on reality.
Thanks a lot, Hans. You got any comment about that, Lara?
It's definitely the case that whenever you want to be able to think about something more precisely, people tend to develop new vocabularies that will be useful to them. You see this in every field of expertise. And there are some really good reasons for it. If you're out sailing and someone tells you to pull the left line, you don't want to stop and say, wait, you mean your left or my left? And for that reason, you have port and starboard. So it is unambiguous and you don't go overboard.
We've got some email here from Deborah in Conway, who says, culture often involves really fundamental texts that are basic to a culture. Can you really understand the language without immersing yourself in those texts, for example, Quran and Arabic?
It's definitely the case that every language goes with the culture that created it. I like the analogy that came up of words as being tools. You can think of a language as being a toolbox. It's a toolbox that has been put together over thousands of years by a culture that needed to solve certain problems. And so definitely the two will go together.
I want to ask you, I want to take you back to this variability thing, because there's a certain, here's a point I agree with, a kind of Kantian point, that you have to, the world doesn't just rush in you and provide for you its own categorization. Something in your head has to construe the world for you. But it seems to me, and Kant thought there was a kind of set of universal categories. I'm not quite sure that's right, but it does seem to me that maybe there's a certain plasticity. So categories grow and decay, right? And that the language gets shaped more by the categories we deploy rather than, I mean, maybe there's a feedback, but it's not like the language just comes with a set of fixed categories and says, okay, now you're going to think about the world this way, right? It's rather, you know, the language warps, the set of categorizations we deploy change. That changes the way we talk. You know, once we think that mass is a relativistic term, we invent a science that has a parameter for a framework where in our old thing we didn't have that. So there's a certain kind of plasticity and changeability.
I'm all for plasticity. I think, in fact, this whole question about whether language shapes thought is fundamentally a question about plasticity, about whether certain aspects of experience can shape you. But I also think that the point you're making is a different point depending on whether you're talking about language change across generations, as humans, cultures change language and invent language, or if you're just talking about an individual being born into a culture and into a huge, complex linguistic system, which will come with all these insights and all these connections essentially for free. And so as in an individual's development, most of what you get is learning the language and learning the insights of other people. Across many generations, what you have is human culture changing language.
I agree about that, but I still think, see, I'm not sure about priority, because it's true. Here's something I think I don't agree with Chomsky's about. I mean, when you're learning a language, you're also learning about the world. How can you separate out the contribution of this sort of pure language learning from learning about the world? I grew up in a philosophical tradition where you says you can't really make that distinct. You can't really make that separation. But you're doing two things. You're learning your culture set of categorizations, and you're learning a language. You're learning this instrument for coordinating your activity.
Here's a way of thinking about it. When you're born into the world, you have two kind of input channels. There's perception, the world impinging on you, and you also have this continuous stream of language, people talking to you. In fact, you have language before you open your eyes. Infants are listening to their mothers while they're still in their wombs. And while perception is kind of promiscuous, there's so many things you could pay attention to and notice, what language is telling you is, these are the things that people before you have found important. These are the small set of categories, the small set of information that we find useful. And so language is helping you hone your attention to the things that are going to be most useful, most important for you.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing language and thought with Lera Boroditsky from Stanford University.
We've been examining some of the empirical research on linguistic relativity and its relation to culture. In the next segment, we're going to ask how much of the diversity of thought and culture around the world is really due to language, and whether there's any possibility of bridging important gaps between cultures and peoples with language. The numbers, 415-841-4134, outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917.
Cultural gaps, linguistic caps, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
You know, if talk was criminal, you'd lead a life of crime. Because your mind is on vacation and your mouth is working overtime.
Mose Allison, your mind is on vacation, but your mouth is working overtime. What a great line. If silence was golden, you couldn't raise a dime. I'm going to remember that. Great music this week from our production staff. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Tell us your thoughts about linguistic relativity by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, you can call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
Lara, I ask you about a strong and weak version of the superior wharf hypothesis. And to my surprise, you said, I think that strong version where languages aren't really intertranslatable are what philosophers call incommensurable. You think there's some, you tend to believe that. But so far, the experimental results we've talked about, I know there's lots more that you could tell us, don't seem to support such a strong version of the thing. Tell me why believe the strongest version. And if there are some experiments that decisively settle this, I'd love to hear those too.
Well, let me give you a metaphor for the strong version. So we've been talking about language as being a set of tools, and you can imagine every language is its own toolbox with all kinds of different tools that have been developed over time by people. Now, you could ask speakers of different languages to solve a problem, and many of them might be able to do it because there are many different tools that could solve that problem. So say you need to tighten some screw or something like this, and you might have a screwdriver, you might have a totally different kind of tool. And at the end of the day, you would say, look, everyone was able to do it, or most people were able to do it, so there's no problem, even though they use different tools. But if you look at how people solve the problem, someone might use a screwdriver. In another culture, they might only have tools that handle really big things, so you have to actually turn the house rather than turning the screw, right? Yeah. In some languages, you might have a tool that instead of turning the screw, destroys it and creates a new screw in a different place, right? And so by looking in detail at how people actually go about solving that problem, you say, you know, there's nothing really similar about what they're doing.
But so, okay. I mean, I get the metaphor. I get the metaphor. But again, about this plasticity and innovation, again, we said, you and John agreed, I like it, language is sparse. So it's true, the kind of fixed and ready set of tools. So something that might be difficult, given that you're reared in this system of representation, might be easy if you're reared in that set of representations. But I guess the Chomsky and Universalist in me thinks, oh, that's just kind of local, right? I mean, at the bottom, there's this universal capacity. I guess the Cartesian in me, you know, human thought is a universal instrument, can do everything well. I guess something tugs at my heart about that. Because we all start out kind of equipotent and we learn all these different languages. People do acquire second languages. The first one interferes, to be sure, but they do acquire it.
Right. But the question is, what is it that you acquire in your second language? Does the eventual state that you get to in your second language, is it the same place as you would have gotten if it was your first language?
Take that Australian Aborigine language you were talking about. I can imagine learning it. I can imagine my wife learning it. I can imagine using it very ineptly. My wife, bless her heart, really isn't very good at north, south, east, west. Very good at left, right. I really don't think she could get that capacity, and I don't think I could either.
Lily in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lily.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I have an example that I think is illustrative, and I'm not exactly sure of what, and I wanted to get your take on it.
Okay.
I'm a native English speaker. I learned French probably some 20 years ago now, and a couple years ago I did a silent retreat for 10 days, and I found that I started to think in French. I actually just started to think, and we didn't speak at all, so that wasn't even an issue. And I just wonder about the connection between that, literally the connection of thought and when it becomes spoken language, because when I was thinking, English just went away.
Yeah, that's a good question, Lily. Larry, you want to weigh in on that?
I think it's interesting that we talk about language as not just a form of communication, but also as a mode of thought. So a lot of people, if you ask them, how is it that you think to yourself, people say, well, I essentially talk to myself. And I know I talk to myself, and lots of people think that this is an important part of thinking. And that's when the question of language and thought becomes extremely interesting, because it's not just what you say to other people, it's not just what you communicate between people, but it's also the very tools for thinking that you have in your mind.
Can you measure? I mean, is there a way to experimentally test whether thinking to yourself and there's a difference between sort of thinking to yourself and the influence of language and thinking to yourself and the influence of language and communication?
The way we usually try to get at that question is to get people engaged in tasks that don't require them to communicate in any way. So get them to draw something, for example, or get them to give us similarity ratings or press buttons as quickly as possible. Do anything but talk, because fundamentally the question of does language shape thought is about whether when you're thinking, not when you're talking, you're thinking differently.
Lara, over most of human evolution, there have been people evolving quite separately. It's so far as our culture and language, maybe just separated by a mountain and two little valleys. They hardly ever interconnect and communicate, the Australian Aborigines, the various Native American tribes. This is a gold mine of for studying the kind of issues you raise, but we're losing it, aren't we, as the world becomes one linguistic community? Has linguistics and psychology really got the resources to get out there and mine this gold mine of information about linguistic relativity before it's lost?
Well, what we're working actively to try to save some of the languages that are disappearing. In fact, we stand to lose about 90% of linguistic diversity in the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. That's the estimate. There are about 6,000 languages still alive now, but most of these have only a few speakers left. And it's a great tragedy because each language is such a finely crafted cultural artifact that has evolved over thousands of years.
But John's question presupposes something. Do you not see these effects of linguistic relativity on sort of world languages like Spanish, French, German, English? I mean, if you looked at the difference between Chinese speakers, French speakers, Germans, would you find any kind of signs of linguistic relativity?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, some of the clearest examples of linguistic relativity come from fairly mundane languages like, you know, to us, Spanish or German. So we did a study, for example, asking the following very silly question. Does grammatical gender marking in languages affect the way you think? So if tables or chairs are masculine or feminine in your language, does that mean that you think of them as actually being more like boys or like girls? And it turns out that is the case. And in fact, you don't even need to do a lab study about this. You can go to your local art gallery and ask, how do painters or sculptors portray things like sin or death or victory? Do they choose a male form or a female form? And if so, why?
And does it work the other way? Do you think of boys and girls as more like tables and chairs, depending on...
That would depend on the statistics of the language. If it just so happens that we talk much more about other people than we do about tables and chairs.
Oh, we got time for one last caller. Bill in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bill.
Yes, my comment goes to the issue of innate factors in language versus cultural adaptation. Genetics shows that we have some biomolecular machinery that can be considered a language. We also have all of what you've been discussing about the cultural factors relating to language. If you look at language in the abstract as a way systems exchange information and then go the axis of culture, genetics, and physics, you can see that you step in and out of the innate versus cultural adaptation view, and you see that there's both aspects, or you look at the dance of the bees and so on. So do you want to comment on the interplay between the innate aspects of language and the cultural?
Thanks, Bill. That's an excellent question.
This is, of course, part of the big nature-nurture debate. Is it all innate? Is it all part of experience? Of course, the answer to all of these questions, it's all a little bit of both, and it's really hard to differentiate where one ends and the other begins. You can ask the nurture part of the question very precisely by looking at aspects of culture that differ, and things that differ, you know, are part of nurture and can't be attributed to nature. The nature part is considerably harder to test. Humans are the only animals that have the linguistic capacity that we have, and nothing as rich appears anywhere else in the animal kingdom. And so we have a limited set of resources for studying it because we are the only ones that do it.
But you can ask this question, this Chomskyan's question. You could try to figure out how much languages vary and in what ways they vary, and if the variation is constrained in some way that's not just explainable by appeal to variance in the environment, right? It's still hard, but it seems to me semi-tractable rather than intractable.
I think there are lots of interesting questions, and there are certainly trade-offs that languages make, and there are all kinds of design principles that go into the makeup of languages. However, ultimately, arguments about whether things are similar or different in languages come down to the following. A linguist or an anthropologist discovers a new feature of a language and they say, ah, that's just like X or Y in my language. And you can find similarities if you're looking for them, and you can find differences. Let me just give you an example. When first the Bible was being translated, Latin scholars went around and collected information on all kinds of languages, and they determined that every language had six cases, just like in Latin, because they would ask for all the six cases, and they would get them.
Yeah, I take your point. Larry, on that note, I'm going to have to say goodbye to you. It's been great having you with us. I hope you come back sometime.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Lara Boroditsky, professor of psychology at Stanford University, author of Linguistic Relativity in the Encyclopedia of Cognitive Science, and a whole slew of other things.
We want to thank the callers we didn't get a chance to get to, a whole line of them as we broke off here, and the emailers whose email we didn't get a chance to read.
So, John, what did you learn today?
Well, I learned that some sophisticated version of the Whorf hypothesis is alive and well in the work of the young linguists and psychologists and cognitive scientists that are replacing us in the university.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, there was a time when this, in circles you and I both travel in, sort of high church cognitive science, where this was a dead letter. I mean, if this was a dead letter, but it's made a comeback, and it's made a comeback not just on the basis of, not at all, I guess, on the basis of philosophical arguments, but if people actually go out and look.
Yeah, it's amazing how well science does without paying attention to what philosophers say sometimes.
Well, I mean, sometimes we need to pay attention to them. Sometimes they need to pay attention to us. It's a kind of two-way street, right?
I want to mention a couple of books that listeners might pick up to find out more about what we've been talking about. First, there's the classics, Language, Thought, and Reality by Benjamin Whorf, that's Whorf. And then Edward Sapir, Sapir, his famous book Language, that's available in paperback, I know. For more recent work, Language and Mind, Advances in the Study of Language and Thought, that's a paperback edited by Deidre Gentner. And finally, Ken brought up Chomsky a lot, Noam Chomsky, New Horizons in the Study of Language and Mind, for a fairly recent version of his theory.
Which is not at all Whorfian, because of this universal grammar thing, which I still am a believer in. I still am a believer in. But you know what? This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
You can also get podcasts from our website. For a final reality check on language and thought, we're going to turn to Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the view of language as cultural has been replaced pretty much by the Chomskyan view that language is innate. Now, back in the 30s, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis stated that there is a systematic relationship between the grammatical categories of a person's language and how that person understands the world. Benjamin Whorf was an inspector for Hartford Fire Insurance at the same time, coincidentally, as the poet Wallace Stevens. In the 30s, he went back to school at Yale, studying under Edward Sapir. Though Whorf was eventually appointed honorary research fellow in anthropology at Yale, he never took up linguistics as a profession. Still, he had quite an influence back in the day. In one of Whorf's essays about linguistic relativity, he cited Franz Boas, who wrote that Eskimos had four words for snow. Whorf upped the ante and claimed that Eskimos had seven words for snow. And thus he started an urban myth snowball rolling. Over the years, the exact number of Eskimo words for snow has changed many times, 32, 50. In 1984, a New York Times editorial gave it as 100. Poor Eskimos, they've been accused of rubbing noses instead of kissing, of being the victims of fast-talking salesmen trying to sell them refrigerators, of leaving their old out on ice floes to die, of eating raw blubber and letting their spouses sleep with strangers as a gesture of hospitality. And poor Benjamin Whorf, he's been accused of racism for using the term Eskimo instead of Inuit, even though Inuits themselves apparently don't find the term offensive. And, his critics point out, there is not one Eskimo language, but many. One language, Yupik, for example, has been estimated to have around 24 words for snow. But so what, say critics? English has at least 40, including hail, ice, slush, flurry, sleet, and blizzard. Then there's a question of what is meant by word. Inuit languages, it is said, are polysynthetic, meaning that hundreds of words can be formed from any root, not just snow, which means the actual number of Eskimo words for snow is infinite. In a way, it doesn't matter. Linguist Jeff Nunberg wrote an essay making the point that the Eskimo words for snow story isn't about Eskimos, it's about the rest of us. He wrote that, quote, writers use this story in the course of talking about the richness of some specialized vocabulary. College students' words for throwing up, corporate euphemisms for firing people, Ben and Jerry's ice cream flavors, the Gambino crime family's words for doing away with people, unquote. And Nunberg remarks that sneering critics miss Whorf's central point. Whorf wrote, to an Eskimo, this all-inclusive word snow would be almost unthinkable. In other words, the mythical Eskimo words for snow aren't synonyms, they are each specific. So even if it's not true, it makes sense that people who live with snow year-round would have a word for snow that can kill you, another word for snow that falls sideways, a word for snow that hasn't fallen yet, a word for snow on a dog, but they don't.
Watch out where the huskies go, and don't you eat that yellow snow.
Oh, did you know that Eskimos don't live in igloos? No, they live in what are called houses. I gotta go.
The deadly yellow snow from right there where the huskies go.
Wow, Ken, my head is dizzy from 60 seconds of rapid-fire philosophy.
If your head is dizzy, that means you've got a conundrum in your mind, and we can solve it for you, can't we, John?
Yes. Go to our webpage,
conundrums@philosophytalk.org, or hit that conundrums button on the webpage. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2006.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Temption, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.